This is Representative Mark Wilson. I call the local government committee meeting to order for March 22nd. It's 12:30. Welcome to the committee. Just in time, Representative Schroen. There's a quorum being present. Representative Samuelson, have you had a chance to look at the minutes for March 20th?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, and I will move them.
Representative Samuelson moves approval of the March 20th minutes. Minutes for the March 20th meeting. Any discussion of that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The minutes for March 20th are approved. Thank you, members. We have four or five bills on the agenda today. The first one up is Representative Budd. Welcome to the committee. We have no surprises for you.
Well, good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really do appreciate that, and I don't think I have any surprises for you either.
Good.
Essentially, the language 3302 has been agreed to by various parties who have been working hard on it to make it palatable. And, Mr. Chair, the language essentially codifies court decisions that compel the approval of a plat that meets local standards unless there's written documentation in the record which supports denial.
And, Representative Broad, the only thing I noted missing on the agenda today was this needs to go to, did you say, it goes to the floor?
Yeah.
Okay, so we go to the General Register. The Chair will move House Bill 3302 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. And, Representative Broad, you have a delete everything amendment to get it in the order you would like?
I do, Mr. Chair. It's the A2 amendment.
What's it? Okay. What was the number?
A2, Mr. Chair.
A2. Here we go. I don't want to adopt Representative Vandeveer's amendment to your bill.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The Chair will move the A2 amendment to be adopted to get it in order, get the bill in the order that the author would like. Discussion of that motion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We have the bill, and begging your pardon, I had stated by looking at the other amendment that it was a delete all. This is not a delete all.
Correct, Mr. Chair. This is the amendment that has been agreed to by the various parties and I think takes care of all the concerns that were out there.
Apologize for that misrepresentation. Hopefully nobody has any questions or misunderstanding from that. Two-year bill as amended. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, essentially the language will codify some court decisions that compel the approval of a plat unless the local jurisdiction can identify something within the public record that supports the denial. Minnesota court cases have routinely upheld that a local government must approve these plats unless the jurisdiction can identify these things that have legitimate health, safety, and welfare concerns for rejecting the plat. Mr. Chair, that's essentially the testimony that I do have for you.
Okay, questions to the author? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Broad, is this just a compromise in the House, or is this also a compromise with the Senate? I mean, how committed to this compromise are all the parties?
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, this language was adopted in the Senate, and this is a compromise that is agreed to through and through, from my understanding. This is a language on both sides of the House and the Senate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion. So the bill is amended. Anybody in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Seeing no further discussion, the Chair renews his motion that House Bill 3302 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the General Register. Any further discussion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The bill is passed as amended and be sent to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Brown. Next, we have House Bill 2965, Representative Vandeveer. Good to see you again, Representative Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's great to be here.
Members, the bill itself is not in your packet. This was held over from previous meetings, as you know. But there's a delete all amendment. See, that was adopted already to that bill. So the language we're working off of is that language. And I will move that House File 2965 be recommended to pass as amended already in a previous meeting and be sent to the General Register. We have the bill before us. Representative Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Members, what House File 2965 is attempting to deal with is a situation that very few people know anything about. And it's some counties in Minnesota and some municipalities have ordinances that say that a non-conforming lot that is otherwise buildable as a lot of record would not be if the owner of that lot also owned another contiguous lot or another piece of property touching the non-conforming lot. And that, I think, is, you know, while, you know, there may be testifiers as to why that those ordinances exist, may be a benefit in some respects. I think that as we look at the situation and as you hear some testimony today, you'll realize that while the goal might be good to make some non-conforming lots that would otherwise be buildable non-buildable, the method for achieving that goal is certainly one that is probably not what we would consider just. And so my first testifier, who's going to kind of describe their situation, is Ms. Katie Hanslin, and she can...
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Thank you. My name is Katie Hanslin, and I live at 701 3rd Street, Forest Lake, Minnesota. And I'm here speaking for myself, my husband Peter, as well as my parents Bruce and Melissa Anderson, who reside at 9505 North Shore Trail in Forest Lake. I want to thank Representative Vandeveer and this committee for giving me the chance to share our testimony today. So here's our situation. I'll be rather brief. I could talk about it for a long time, but I won't take your time. My parents bought two lots on Forest Lake 2 years ago from our relatives Dr. Lewis and Jesse Roberts. These lots were legally created in the 1950s and have two separate registers and titles. My parents' house is on one lot and the other lot is vacant. My parents visited the Roberts often and always had talked about someday purchasing and living on these lots. My parents and the Roberts were excited about having another family member someday build on that vacant lot. When Dr. Roberts passed away a couple years ago and Jesse moved into a senior housing facility, my parents moved in and the plans were laid for my husband and myself to go ahead and build next door. As a youth pastor in Forest Lake, I work many days, nights with teenagers in the community, as well as I'm having my first child this summer. I was very excited and blessed to have my parents to be living right next door to myself. But our nightmare began when we went to the city of Forest Lake to get a building permit to build our house on the lot next to my parents, and the city told us that we couldn't build. We were kind of in a state of shock. I really didn't understand why. But we were told that because my parents owned both lots, that we couldn't build. That was enough to make us cry. But then when the city told us that if a guy from California had owned the lot, he would be able to build a house. Which really, as a family, we felt very angry and dismayed at what ridiculous law had caused this situation to occur. And as you can see, I don't know if everyone picked up their copies or not, but there's a just listed. And people are getting building permits to build on a lot that is non-conforming, a 50-foot lot they consider non-conforming. And other people can build on those size lots. This is a brand new house just built last year on a 50-foot lot. But they're saying because my parents own both, it's non-conforming and it's a contiguous, that we would not be able to build there. But a guy from California would be able to. Thankfully, Representative Vandeveer has seen the burden and harm given to families in our situation and wants to return to families their rights to property ownership. Some officials at every level of government can't believe that this could actually happen. State representatives, state senators support us. The city mayor of Forest Lake supports us. Council members support us. We have documentations of families in Burnsville, Pine County, Washington County, all fighting the exact same issue. Lots legally bought and paid for in the past to pass on to family members are being taken away. I certainly hope this isn't what our state lawmakers deem fair and just. In conclusion, legal lots with separate legal registered titles bought for family use should never be taken away by future government. This is exactly what happened to Dr. Lewis and Jesse Roberts 50 years ago when they bought these lots for their family to enjoy. We hope you see the injustice in this situation and can help make it right for families to have what should be theirs in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vandenberg, do you want to go through, I see a list of test fires, do you want to go through all of them before we take questions?
Mr. Chair, I think that would probably be helpful so that the members get a full picture, because there's a couple different variances on this, and you might have a better understanding after the witnesses are done.
So. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Heslin. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Thank you for hearing me. My name is Nancy Ness. Do I need to give you my address? Or?
No, that's fine.
My husband David and I own two adjoining parcels of real estate located in Bay Lake Township in Crow Wing County. Parcel A is an improved parcel of real estate that has been owned by my family for nearly 50 years, and it contains a lake home that we have continuously used. Parcel A is a legal non-conforming use in the county since it is less than the minimum lot size in the zoning district. However, the Crow Wing County zoning ordinances and Minnesota statutes provide that a legal non-conforming use have the right to continue. Parcel B immediately adjoins Parcel A and contains an existing lake home. My husband and I purchased Parcel B in December of 2002. Parcel B is a legal conforming use since the parcel size significantly exceeds the minimum requirements. Our intent in purchasing Parcel B was to demolish the existing structure on the newly acquired parcel and construct a new home in compliance with all of the city's requirements. Parcel A and Parcel B have separate and distinct real estate tax statements. After acquiring Parcel B, the county informed us that because Parcel A and B were now under common ownership, we could not demolish and rebuild the existing structure on Parcel B. The county's position is that Parcel A legal non-conforming parcel, must now be combined with legal conforming parcel to create one legal non-conforming parcel, since they were now under common ownership. The county's position that Parcel A and Parcel B constitute one lot is based solely on their ordinance, which provides that legal non-conforming parcels must be combined with adjoining parcels if they are under common ownership. If anyone else or any of you would have purchased Parcel B, they could demolish the home and rebuild since they would remain separate parcels. We are prohibited by doing this only because we own the adjoining legal non-conforming parcel. Due to the county's interpretation, we are unable to build on the conforming parcel as we intend and are unable to sell the conforming parcel without selling Parcel A, which has been in my family for 50 years. It's unfair that Parcel A and B are now combined, not based upon land use, but solely based on the fact that they are under common ownership. The unfairness of this is further emphasized by the fact that if the home on Parcel B were destroyed by fire or tornado, it could not be rebuilt. And what's really frustrating is that our neighbors who have the same size, right next door, have the same size lot that Parcel A is, which is the non-conforming lot, a few months ago were able to go in and get an over-the-counter permit to build new. We can't even build on a conforming lot because they're contiguous. It doesn't seem fair.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Vandenberg?
I think we have one more testifier and then two possibly. I think we'll probably ask Marvin List to come down, but we have another person who contacted me today and who has a similar story to tell, and they're going to tell it real quickly.
To get a sense for your negotiations on this bill, Representative Vandenberg, because you have all new names on the, on almost all new names on the test file list.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank
State
you.
Your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Marvin List. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Burnick and Lipson, 5500 Wise Meadow Boulevard. I represent the Nesses, and as a practitioner of real estate law for 30 years, every year I go through the legislative calendar and track what's going on, and I came across Representative Vandenberg's bill and said, my gosh, this is the same thing, same problem the Nesses have. And so I called him and talked about it. I just like to just very, very briefly talk about my thoughts on the practices that, that the ordinances result in. It's really a gotcha ordinance. There's a shoreland management regulation which these ordinances are based upon, which basically say we're going to get rid of non-conforming lots from being used if the same owner coincidentally owns an adjoining parcel. Then we're going to magnetize them, if that's a word, and then make them one lot. And in effect, making the non-conforming parcel no longer usable for any purpose. If I bought it, as opposed to the Andersons, or if I bought that lot in the Nessa situation, other than any than their parents,
no.
I could build on that lot. It's only because their parents bought it, who owned the adjoining parcel, that they are deprived of that right forever. They can't sell the contiguous lot because the counties combine them now into one parcel. In the Nessa situation, they owned this non-conforming parcel for 50 years. Then they bought a conforming parcel. And now Crow Wing County says this whole piece of real estate is one non-conforming parcel because it has two separate structures. So they've taken a conforming parcel and made it non-conforming. It's a bizarre situation that you can't believe unless you actually look at these different scenarios. I understand, I think, what these counties are trying to do is say, gee, we don't want new buildings on these substandard lots. But it's done so unfairly because they don't enforce it for people who can walk in over the counter who own that non-conforming lot, but yet someone who owns it but also who owns a similar one, but then also owns the adjoining parcel, is deprived of that right. It's as Representative Vandenberg said at the outset, it's a very unjust way of trying to do something. And the reason it's a gotcha is because people like the Nesses and the Andersons buy these not knowing that these ordinances take effect and are deprived of the right to be able to use that lot, whereas anybody else in the world could buy it and use it. Finally, the last point. Well, you know what? That takes care of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Chris Gilmore. I purchased this cabin on Cross Lake in Pine City, Minnesota, 1998, as a 50 by 200 foot lot. I moved permanently into this cabin in the year 2000, homesteaded the property. In 2001, I purchased the cabin next to me for my boy-girl twin children, who were 13 years old at the time, to use on weekend visitations. I was divorced at the time. This is also a 50 by 210 foot lot. The first cabin only has one bedroom with a walkout basement. The second cabin has two bedrooms. I wanted each of my children to have a room of their own, especially for my daughter since she was maturing into a young woman at the time. My plan was to own this cabin for 3 to 4 years, at which time my children would be ready to go to college and the cabin would no longer be used. I tried to homestead the second property, but was denied because it was a separate lot with a separate dwelling. I was fine with that because that made sense to me at the time. These two cabins are in an area of about 40 cabins in a row built in the 1960s and are all 50-foot shoreline lots. There are other sections on the lake with the same type of layout. In the spring of 2004, I wanted to sell the property, but was informed that I could not due to a shoreline management law. I went to the Pine County Commissioners to have a variance granted. They came out, looked at the properties, felt I met all the variance requirements, and granted me the variance. The state of Minnesota challenged their ruling, and I was denied the variance in district court in the fall of 2005. These cabins are year-round. They each have separate city sewer, natural gas, electrical, and water hookups. They both have their own detached garages. From my understanding, the intent of the law was to limit undeveloped tracts of land from being divided into smaller lots. They need to be 75 feet minimum, therefore limiting septic systems and overuse of the shoreline to protect the lake water quality. If this is true, I should have been allowed to keep the variance granted to me. My property was developed long before the law came into effect. The cabins are hooked up to city sewer, therefore no risk of septic systems leaching in the lake, and I keep the natural berm and native weeds along the shoreline to prevent and filter any rain runoff. I am an ideal lakeshore owner for the DNR. On the Snake River that flows into Cross Lake, lots are to be 200 feet minimum of shoreline. If this is true, how come a developer can come in 2 to 3 years ago, took undeveloped property, and built townhomes along the river with 4 townhomes for every 200 feet lakeshore? That averages 50 feet per unit, far below what the law allows. The way the current law has affected me, I am forced to sell both lots since I cannot afford both cabins with my children out of college. This means I'm being forced off the lake. Two middle-income families can't own these two separate properties, and only a high-income person could afford to buy both at the same time. I'm sure the shoreline will then be torn up and groomed for visual aesthetics. Very few of the current small lot and cabin owners have done that. This law is inconsistent. Does not allow people with more than one existing developed lot as the same rights to sell one of them as people with one lot. It is not managing the shoreline. And it does not allow leeway for differing circumstances. Tries to fit one law for every situation.
Thank you. I think that's all the testifiers we have, members.
Want your questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Questions for the author or anybody who testified? Representative Hamar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vanderbilt, I thought that originally when you proposed this bill, it was for this one constituent that you had in Forest Lake. And so now, it seemed like it was narrowly tailored for that constituent. Maybe I misunderstood. Now it seems like it's it would have statewide implications, and I'm just wondering, I guess that's the way we do things here sometimes, but no one from Crow Wing County, for instance, no public official from Crow Wing County has been notified, City of Forest Lake. I mean, out of cities and counties that seem to, it would be important, I think, to hear from them about what this bill will do and why. I mean, it does seem like it puts property owners in a difficult position, but there must be some reason why cities and counties have this language in their ordinances.
Representative Vanderbilt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymer, with regards to your first comment, House File 2965 was not crafted just for one single. It wasn't intended to work for one single property owner. When I heard the story of my constituents, it occurred to me that just simply basing ownership as a single criteria on whether something's buildable or not, or something that would otherwise be buildable, was wrong and certainly a violation of property rights. But with regard to your second question, the mayor of Forest Lake has told me that he had wanted to be here today, and this is an issue we agree on, and he supports the legislation because, he feels the same as we do, that this is quite egregious and unfair. With regard to your third comment, is the counties, knowing they are here to testify. In fact, we were going to hear this bill last week, and decided to put it off to allow more time to discuss this and for them to get up to speed as to what it actually does. So they, I think that someone from the counties and the cities will be testifying. So,
thank you.
Representative Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I was just questioning because I'm kind of confused on this. If I have a home on a lake in a lot that is non-conforming, but the lot next to me is non-conforming either, and someone sells me that lot so that it becomes conforming, does that work or not?
Representative Landveer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Samuelson, I think if you're talking about intentionally combining lots, I think that does work.
Okay.
I think the issue here is if the lots were legally buildable when you bought each one of them, then even though they might have been non-conforming, at the point where you bought them, they would now be not buildable because you own both of them. That's what the bill is intended to address.
They would be not buildable.
It depends on if the new lot was conforming or not, legal and conforming. That I think you're talking about combining them. We're talking about people who are buying lots of record that are buildable, and they own the one. If you owned one of them, and that was non-conforming and buildable, and you bought the one next to it, and that was non-conforming and buildable, now the two lots would only be buildable as one
because
you owned it. Whereas if Representative Garfalo had bought the one next door, he could build on that one. It's just you that couldn't because you would own both.
Okay.
Does that make it more confusing? Or
Representative, that does clarify it for me anyway. But it just doesn't, I guess as people have quoted, it just doesn't seem fair.
Thank you.
Representative Vandiver, and based on one of the testifiers, if the adjoining lot is non-conforming in one case, as I understood it, they were able to build, even though it was non-conforming.
Mr. Chair, that is correct, because lots of record can be legal, non-conforming, and be buildable, provided you meet all the other setbacks. And we want to make clear, this doesn't affect any of that. This isn't trying to make otherwise unbuildable lots buildable. It's only dealing with lots that are buildable unless you have, you know, you're unlucky enough to have the same name as the person that owns the lot next to you. So,
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I understand correctly, I think one of the reasons this is set up the way it is to reduce the density on some of these lakes and require the lots to be bigger. I have for a long time not understood how years ago, when land was much more plentiful than it is today, that we platted such small lots. That has made no sense to me for a long time. But my recollection of a similar situation here was the legislature passed a number of years ago kind of a moratorium that allowed if an owner had more than one lot, there was a moratorium that would allow them to build a second property on their other lot, their adjoining lot, and that was sunsetted. It was like an open opportunity for a couple of years, year or two, and then it was taken away. Staff, can you help on that? What I'm trying to say here is that at once in the past, the legislature did allow an opportunity for people in this kind of a situation to do what these testifiers are asking for. Am I correct in that recollection?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, I think you're talking about shoreland protection zoning, which has been what's been presented by the witnesses, and that's a topic that actually has been covered in the Environment Committee, and I'm not familiar with it. I don't think it's been in front of this committee in the time that I've been covering. So I'm not familiar with the moratorium that you're talking about, but it may well be something that was discussed and handled in the Environment Committee, and probably other witnesses that are here might know more about it.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Lanning?
Representative Vannevere, are you aware of that history?
No, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lanning, I'm not. I hadn't heard of that. But I would say that if that was quite a few years ago, that existing, I'm not sure. Well, I would have to see what, if it was dealing with these specific types of legal non-conforming lots. But I'm not sure. I think, as Mr. Liss said, that people today have this, and know it, understand it, and have any access to the same remedy. So I am not familiar with it, no.
Well, Mr. Chair,
what's in line?
I can personally relate to this. I own three lots on a lake, and there was a period of time where I could have separated those. Even they are separate lots; they're listed separately. But because I own them, I cannot build a second property, like a guest cabin or whatever, on it. And there was a period of time where I was allowed to do that if I went through the process. And so I'm pretty sure that situation relates to what you're bringing to us today.
Representative Vander.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, the only thing that makes me question that is the fact that this is not state law. This is ordinances that not every city and county have. Only some have adopted this particular part of the shoreline ordinance. So it is not consistent throughout the state. So it's something, though, that, you know, maybe we should know.
Representative Marquardt. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Representative Lanning is right on with that, because family had land in the same county, same situation. And, in fact, some of those lots were 30 feet. You talk about narrow lot. They were actually allowed to be platted out at 30 foot lots, but and we didn't do anything with that either, but we did run into that language where you had a certain amount of time, and we really ran into it by accident. And so that kind of leads to another question, is really the notices. You know, I was looking at, I don't know who distributed this. Is that from you, Representative Anderson?
Yes, it is.
And there's a quote here. There's a family that was not aware of the ordinance, even much less if the state gave that moratorium. But there's a council member who says here, quote, "You're not excused for being naive nor ignorant of the law and ordinance." Now, it just really burns me, because, you know, those notices are put in agate type, the back page. And when we're talking about property rights, as we spent 2 weeks or more talking about eminent domain, that's more than just losing whatever. I mean, this is losing your right to use your property as you wish. And maybe we need better notices when it comes to something that, in fact, is mentioned in the Constitution, property. There maybe should be more than a little agate type that there's a new ordinance here. And if you're a lake owner and you don't live in the district, that official newspaper you may never see. Mm-hmm. It could be hundreds of miles away. So that brings up a question. It really burns me when local officials hide behind that type of a thing when they don't publicize it too well to start with. A couple other things real quick. Just in what I'm hearing, I really do sympathize with these stories that I'm hearing. And you know, we talk about on income tax with the marriage penalty. This looks like a marriage penalty or family penalty referring to land. And the third thing is, and I understand what the idea is, as Representative Lanning mentioned, you know, it's to create less density and make lots larger. But the fact of the matter is, in most of these cases, you have lakes that already have the 50-foot lots. You already have that. So by continuing with what you would be doing would be consistent with the development around that lake already. So it's not like you're upsetting the apple cart by all of a sudden this
smaller lot because all the rest of them are 50 foot too. So I would like to see us do something in this area. I really would. And I don't know how you'd do it for sure, but it really is penalizing owners who have in good faith all these years operated under an assumption. Certainly the law might be out there, how well it was put out there. But also their development, even if they did develop on that other lot, would not be inconsistent with, I'm sure, what is already being developed around that lake, and maybe work it into, you know, is it consistent with what's existing development? But I do appreciate you bringing this bill forward.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning and Representative Marquardt have brought up a good point. And one thing we might want to consider is putting a sunset in this if it's going to go forward, and then maybe adding something about notices. But
Representative Wardlow.
I almost forgot, Mr. Chair. Way back when Representative Samuelson was talking about adjoining parcels that are non-conforming, it was just a point of clarification. The example that the Ness family gave us, the original parcel was non-conforming but legal for 50 years or something, but the one they bought next to it was legal and conforming. They were not both non-conforming. It's a minor point, but I just thought I'd clarification for Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Representative Wardlow. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess this question would be for staff, but I remember when the shoreland regulations became effective, because I was on the city council at the time, it was a long time ago, I'm guessing 20 to 25 years ago, and it seemed at the time, and I think it was a DNR shoreland regulation, that really superseded anything that the city did, and then from that time forward, the city had to conform with those lakeshore shoreland regulations, and they defined distance from the water that you could develop, and they defined lot width. And so from that point forward, we had to conform with that. And is that really what we're talking about here? Would you think, is that something that is superseding and making the county pass these ordinances and regulations that would conform with that shoreland regulation?
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Scalzi, the bill that's in front of you is amending the county and municipal planning law, so it would cover all instances. It's not specific to shoreland regulation. So the bill is dealing with the big picture of planning and zoning for counties and cities. As I said earlier, the shoreland regulations is not a section of statute I'm familiar with. I just found it. And there is a provision that says that municipal ordinances can be more restrictive, but I would assume that the state DNR shoreline regulations as to setbacks and everything else does set a minimum standard, but again, whether, as Representative Vanderveer's bill is talking about in terms of ownership of parcel being relevant to that, I think that's a different question. I'm not a person who can speak very clearly on shoreland regulations because it's something that usually the Environment Committee has looked at, and I've not dealt with them before.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if we were to pass this, would we be going contrary to existing state law? Because it would be defined under the DNR shoreland regulations, and maybe we need more investigation on that. I don't know, but I don't know that we could pass this if it would be contrary to the DNR regulations.
Representative Scalzi, we may find that out here soon. We have somebody from the DNR coming up. Good point. Representative Hillstrom, and then we'll go to additional testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vanderveer, is there any requirement for disclosure at the time of sale of property or at the time people are purchasing this property?
I don't believe there is, but everyone's shaking their head no.
Thank you. I have two others on the list to testify. Is Melvin Sin in the audience? Please come forward. And a Jane Conceer. You can both come forward. Welcome to the committee, sir. State your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mel Sin. That's S-I-N-N. And I work for the DNR Division of Waters. And I'd just like to give you a little background. It sort of addresses a couple of the questions that have been raised. Unfortunately, I'm not the department's best person to be talking about this today, but I'll do the best that I can. This concept of, you can call it the catch-ya clause or the combining, I just call it the combining concept, dates back to 1970. That's when the first shoreland state minimum standards for shoreland regulation came into effect. The DNR was directed by the legislature to develop minimum standards. And the concept was simply that you would combine these abutting lots to reduce or eliminate nonconformities over the long haul. When those ordinances were first adopted, basically everything that was out there was grandfathered in. So what was there. Much of it is still there. The concept was appealed by a landowner in Washington County back in the late 80s, and the concept was upheld by the Minnesota Court of Appeals in 1988. So it met a court test. In 1989, the DNR went through and did a major revision to the shoreland minimum state standards for shoreland ordinances and basically kept this concept of combining lots in the modern ordinance for the modern standards. As you stated, the goal is to over time reduce the number of non-conforming lots. It is a tool for local governments to move in that direction. It's a very slow tool in most cases because these changes don't come about that fast. And it is to take advantage of opportunities that arise when these lots come into common ownership, to try to do some merging, to try to make one or more conforming lots out of non-conforming lots. One point I did want to make today is that in some cases, it is a very important tool. And just by coincidence, we were contacted just last week by the zoning administrator in Steele County. And in that case, we have an individual who owns 37 individual non-conforming shoreland lots that all are contiguous. So it's one large group of 37 non-conforming lots. They each have a little cabin. And this owner evidently has rented out these cabins like in a resort type of setup for years. Now he wants to sell out. And he just asked the county last week, or told the county of his plans. He wants to sell each one of these individually with the existing cabin. And if he was allowed to do that, of course, we just have another 37 non-conforming, small-sized lots for who knows how long. But with this tool in place, at least it gives Steele County an opportunity to say, now is the time to put some of these lots together so that we get some larger conform lots that conform to the ordinance. So I guess I would urge you not to just throw the tool out, but to think about alternatives. If there are problems, and honestly, personally, I think there are, especially in this notice, nobody should be surprised to find out that what they thought were two lots, the county or city is considering one. I agree with that. Those kinds of surprises shouldn't happen. How we get there, I'm not sure, but one thing would be I wouldn't want to receive a tax statement with these lots being shown as separate entities on my tax statement, for instance, if the local unit of government believed there were one. That's one thing that should probably change. And there may be many others you can talk about, but I would just say the concept is long-term. It's to take advantage of opportunities to reduce nonconformities. And that's about all I have. Yeah, I'll be glad to answer questions.
Mr. Sim, if I understand it correctly, I'm looking at this handout here, each individual property owner could sell their individual lot. But as soon as somebody owns two of them, they can no longer sell those two lots as two lots. They have to be sold as one.
Correct.
And would that not mean that there's two cabins on it in the case you just identified, that one cabin would have to be torn down?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if one cabin would have to be torn down, but I think the two lot, the county, the local government would be saying is no longer two separate lots. We're considering it one lot for purposes of sale.
I don't know. I think that's very important to consider, because what that leads to is my question. I don't know how we establish that anything ever gets grandfathered in if that's the case, because nobody really is grandfathered in unless they never tried to expand. And that is not what we're looking for. I would think we'd want them. I mean, if I lived in a situation where I had a 30-foot wide lot, even if I liked my neighbors, I think I would hope they'd sell. Because that's a really narrow lot.
Right.
And or hope that I could sell and they could have a wider lot. That's the kind of marketplace activity I would hope we would try to encourage. But to take away the right for families, I mean, I saw heads nodding there. Maybe there's some other information we need to know from Mr. List. If we know that they would have to tear down one of those cabins, because it's probably just a cabin, I think that's very significant that we're doing that to a family but not doing it to individuals. Representative Wardlaw.
I think I see where you're going, because if you don't tear the cabin down, then you got one lot, but you got the same density.
That's right. That's exactly right, Representative Wardlaw. So if we do, Mr. Lewis, if you know that the lots, the cabins have to be torn down in that session. Do you know that? Can you confirm that for the committee?
I can tell you in the Nessus, I can tell you in the Nessus situation, they can't sell. They bought a legal conforming lot. They cannot sell that lot any longer. It is now combined with the non-conforming lot. It's one large non-conforming parcel. And it's non-conforming because it has two structures. They bought their conforming lot to tear it down and build a new one even further away from the lake. But the county won't let them do that because they have one large non-conforming lot and you can only have one structure on a lot. I mean, you may not believe me, but I'm telling you that's true.
Yeah.
And what's more bizarre about it is on the other side of the Nessus, there is somebody who owns a 75-foot lot, which is the same size as their parcel A.
Which is only part of
the non-conforming.
Okay.
They went in last fall over the counter and received a permit to build a structure on that 75-foot lot. As is the same with Ms. Anderson also. The Anderson family. People on Forest Lake are building and receiving the permits on 50-foot lots. They can't because they happen to own a 50-foot lot adjoining it.
Mr. List, it sounds like the scenario you're describing is what we want to happen.
I couldn't agree with you more. Why wouldn't they want them to tear the house down and build it further back?
Right.
But they said no.
Representative Lane.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can agree with the point that's being made here. The three lots that I've owned for a long time, when I bought them, I could have sold them separately to other people when I first bought them. But along the way, that changed where I could no longer do that. And not only that, I've got three 50-foot lots, 150 feet. I've got a small guest cabin. And along the way, I couldn't do anything with that to expand it. If I wanted to add on a room or in any way change it, I couldn't do that. And so, what they're saying is correct, and I can verify that from my own experience. And I understand the reason for this. It's legitimate, but it obviously has taken away some of the rights of the owners.
If I could,
Mr. Lewis,
just add one more thing, Mr. Chair. The gotcha part that I mentioned before is further exemplified by the fact that the people who know about this, they buy the adjoining lot, and what do you think they do? Put it in someone else's name, in an uncle, an aunt, a son, so it's not the same name, so they're not then combined by the ordinance.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask the question about, I know that we're spending a lot of time looking at this from the Lakeshore perspective, but I'd like to know what this really means for legal non-conforming uses, for example, in my city, along roads, along areas that are going to go from residential to commercial, and what the broader implication of this is.
Representative Vandevier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't think there is one. It is not intended to impact the definitions or the lots that are non-conforming. If they're non-conforming, they stay non-conforming. We're not making them conforming. We're just saying it's the only criteria, and I think as was testified by the DNR, it's not a very common situation. But if the only criteria you're using is to whether the property is buildable is the ownership, then in making it non-buildable, then it would have an impact. But it doesn't change non-conforming.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the reason I'm having some confusion about this is because we've also heard about, for example, billboards. I see that Michael, Representative Paymar, is not at his seat, and we've had the debate already about billboards being a non-conforming lot, someone purchasing the land next to it, not being able to build another something until they take down that non-conforming use. And I'm just curious as to how that all plays into this.
Mr. Lewis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what Representative Vandevier mentioned a minute ago is exactly the case. This is saying if the criteria is ownership, that's not the criteria you could use to make it not buildable. If it's not buildable because of setback or any one of a number of other things, that's a different issue. That criteria here is just ownership. Now, I think this bill is actually very narrowly drawn.
Thank you. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we all feel sympathetic for people like the Hensleys and some of these others, but my question is to the legal aspect. Can we legally, as a state, in this committee, and, you know, I don't know where it would go, but can we legally say that the DNR Shoreland standards would be preempted and we would change them? Can we do that legally, or do they supersede what we're doing? Or are we changing the DNR Shoreland standards? Because then couldn't we change setbacks? Could we then change setbacks and everything? Could we actually rewrite the DNR Shoreland standards?
Representative Vandevier. Mr. Chair, I don't think that it's required that you adopt this particular criteria. I don't think that's the case because not every county and city that has the shoreline ordinance has adopted it. This particular criteria is that we believe that's the case, and maybe the DNR can confirm that.
Mr. Sin.
For cities and all counties, but for the counties and some of the cities that have shorelands and that are supposed to adopt the shoreland ordinance, this combining concept, just that narrow concept of combining when they come under common ownership to address these non-conforming lots, is in the state minimum shoreland standards. So just from the perspective of just shoreland ordinances, they should have something in the ordinance that addresses this.
But they don't.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure they all do, but they should to meet the state minimum.
Representative Scalzi.
Well, I know when it happened in my city, we had to adopt shoreland ordinance because state law preempted it. We didn't have a choice to accept it or not. We had to adopt a new shoreland ordinance that would conform to the DNR standards.
But Mr. Chair, it is only an ordinance, and it is a regulation, and we can certainly change that. Because I think, as they said, it doesn't occur frequently, and it's a very slow process for accomplishing their goal, and it sounds like it's probably would not have an impact.
Okay. Other questions for the testifiers? Mr. Sim?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it possible to hear from someone from the league or from a county association just to really address whether or not there are any broader implications?
Representative Philstrom, we have one more testifier on the list. We can certainly ask comments from the league. I see them nodding their head. Thank you for your testimony, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
Jane Consier, begging your pardon if I didn't pronounce that correctly. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is...
Excuse me, could you pull the microphone closer? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jane Consier. I'm the Director of Planning and Building from the City of Prior Lake. I've been asked today to just talk a little about my experience with this type of provision. The City of Prior Lake adopted a similar provision in 1999, and although the shoreline statutes and rules were the impetus for that provision, it does apply to all non-conforming lots within the City of Prior Lake. The purpose, in my opinion, of this provision is to allow the city to eliminate some non-conforming situations that we have, especially along the lake where our older non-conforming lots are often very small. When you are allowed to build on all these small lots, this provision does help to eliminate many of the environmental issues, such as runoff into the lake, impervious surface, which also impacts runoff, and even just more use of the lake itself. Eliminating this provision does put the city in the position of being required to issue building permits on non-conforming lots. In many cases, because those lots are small, it also places the city in the position of having to issue variances to make the lot buildable, to give someone a reasonable use of that property. So often we would be faced with setback issues, both from the lake, side yards, and so on. That can have impacts, not only environmental impacts, but it can impact the visual and just the character of the neighborhood. I think that's all I have to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions I can.
Questions? Representative Markworth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This one, in the City of Prior Lake, how many owners of non-conforming lots approximately do you have? And then how were they notified of this change?
Ms. Consier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't give you an exact number of how many owners we have. I can tell you when we adopted the provision in 1999, we were concerned about that very issue. We had several public hearings. We tried to ask our local newspaper to run more than just a legal notice, you know, do some stories on it, even just a small blurb. And the city also incorporated a sunset provision where we allowed people 6 months to look at different methods of getting those into different ownerships or in some way utilizing that for the very reason that you talked about, for that fairness provision.
Representative Markford.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate that. I mean, just on the matter of owners, I mean, would it be 100 owners, 500, 1,000?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are about 950 lots around the shore of Prior Lake. There are several thousand lots in the Shoreland District and Prior Lake. If you're familiar with the area, we have many lakes, 13 total, within our city limits.
Thank you. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a question for the author, so maybe I'll just wait until
he's... Further questions for the testifier? And we have Mr. Grundhofer. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Kensier. Mr. Grundhofer?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my testimony will be fairly brief. You've already heard sort of the justification, but I think what's been de-emphasized in the justification is it's not just a desire to eliminate non-conforming lots. The whole reason for the shoreline regulations is an environmental concern. I mean, that's the main goal. And I don't, frankly, think Mr. List's description of this as a gotcha law is actually right. I mean, the reality is that most of us, if we're buying property, would go out and determine whether we can use the property for its intended use before we buy it. So, I mean, it's a sympathetic story, I understand, But the reality is you got to know what the regulations are that are affecting your property before you pick that up. And it's not a bill that really deals with familial status. It's a question of common ownership. So even though the stories you've heard have been sort of family-oriented, it is more of a common ownership issue. The final thing I would mention is that, as Representative Hillstrom points out, this isn't a bill that just deals with shoreland. It deals with non-conforming lots anywhere in a county or city. And the goal, of course, over the last couple years, we've dramatically affected, and you have dramatically affected, the ability of local governments to deal with non-conforming lots. And pretty much most of our authority in that area has been eliminated. This is one tool we still do have where their lots are in common ownership to allow us to reduce the number of non-conforming situations. And again, it only applies to lots that are in common ownership. So I'd leave it at that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Grunhofer, to that point, the testifiers have already identified that a non-conforming lot next door received a permit over the counter when, in fact, the lot that was denied had become conforming by joint ownership. So this obviously is not working by that example.
Mr. Chair, most of the time, in order to get a permit, well, legally, in order to get a permit to do something on a non-conforming lot, you would have to seek a variance. Now, whether that practice is occasionally varied from community to community, I don't know, but that would be the legal requirement, that you need a variance.
Even with the variance, Mr. Grunhofer, the lot that was denied was conforming, and they can't get it, and even with a variance, the one next door received it over the counter, but say they got it through a variance, it still is an injustice in showing that this law, current law, is not working in addressing the concerns.
Mr. Chair, I do understand that point. The only rebuttal I could make is that the lot next door that got the variance presumably didn't have another lot next to it where it could have combined. So the combination factor is what differentiates it.
And what I'm trying to point out, and I think it's really important for the committee to look at, because that's the reason this issue is here. It's not the environmental issues. If we need to move this to the environment committee, that's another matter. But the fact of having two lots come together and the owners actually wanted to make the lot conform, increase the setback, tear down the existing, at least one of the, as I understood it, one of the existing units, this is very off. And I want to ask you one question. Can you help me think of an example in any case whatsoever, lakes, signs, what have you, where only ownership should determine whether or not somebody can use their property or not? I mean, when should a policy like what Representative Vandegrift is trying to change ever be invoked?
I mean, we have that law in place in many situations. For instance, in order to get a variance, the hardship that has to be shown must not be sort of self-created or something that's under your control. When you do own a lot next to a non-conforming lot, you do have a situation that's under your control to eliminate that non-conforming situation. I know it's not exactly what you're getting at, but yes, we do have a number of situations where ownership does play a significant part.
Mr. Grunhofer, I haven't heard an example, and I think it's hard to find one. I don't know if it's even possible. But you do identify the additional concern I have with the current law, and that is we create disincentives for meeting the shoreland obligations. We actually have in current policy disincentives for people to comply with our shoreland ordinances. And I'm just going to share with you a concept that came to me here that I think would fit well in this situation and may need to be looked at. And I'm going to share it because I'm going to encourage this bill to go forward, and I hope it does, because I think this is a very serious infraction on property rights. If an owner agrees to buy a neighboring piece of property, knowing that ownership of that neighboring piece of property combined, that neighboring lot combined with their own, turns it into one lot, and they lose rights to that property that somebody else would otherwise have. I would submit that it would be beneficial to then require the local unit of government to establish the valuation of that new larger lot to be equal to the average size of lots surrounding it. So they're at least going to pay property taxes that are equal to the other lots that are grandfathered in. So they don't have an increased annual cost of doubled property taxes. And they then have an incentive to look for opportunities to buy these neighboring lots, join them, and have larger lots. And until all of those lots are bought up and made into larger lots, they would be paying the same property taxes as their neighbors. That creates an incentive to reach our goals. And I think it would be a good piece to put into this discussion in another committee, because I think it would help us reach the environmental objectives. Other questions? We need to move on. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification purposes, probably, so what I understand then, the common ownership for contiguous property, it doesn't matter if it's a conforming to conforming, conforming to non-conforming, or non-conforming to non-conforming. Is that correct? So there's really, it doesn't matter if one property is conforming or not. And it's just that it's a common ownership on two contiguous lots.
Mr. Chair, that is not actually technically correct. I mean, if you have conforming lots, you're not going to obviously be forced to combine them. This is a condition to deal with you when you have non-conforming lots.
Okay, so if there are two contiguous properties with common ownership and they're each conforming, then they can continue to be as two separate lots.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct.
All right. And then my other question, thing, Mr. Chair, is really then when it comes to the three or multiple lots question, if there are three non-conforming, is there a limit to the number of non-conforming lots that can be contiguous that get lumped together?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do not know the answer to that. Maybe the DNR people do.
Mr. Sim?
Yes, I'm very sorry. Could you just repeat that?
Yes. I was just wondering about if there are three or more lots that are contiguous to each other and owned under one common person, if then there's any limit to the number of lots that come together, get lumped together in this situation. Three non-conforming but contiguous lots.
Mr. Sim?
Mr. Chairman, if you could make two conforming out of those three, I'm sure that would be fine. If you couldn't even make one conforming out of the three, then you'd have all three together and you still have a non-conforming lot. So the goal is simply to get two conforming lots to the maximum degree possible is where how the minimum state language reads.
Thank you.
Mr. Tess, do you have information to that? Do you have information to that concern as well?
Mr. Chair, I don't think that last statement is accurate because the conforming lot, if I understood the question, was combined with a non-conforming to make a large non-conforming, if I understood the import of the question.
Okay. And you'd be talking about the situations you're familiar with.
That is correct.
So it could vary by county.
Yes.
Thank you, sir. One more testifier. This was... Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Annalie Garlitz. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. We would just like to echo the comments that the planner from Prior Lake made, in addition to Mr. Grunhofer of the League of Minnesota Cities. This is not only a method of dealing with these nonconformities that are in cities and counties, but it's also a matter of bringing things, it's an environmental concern as well, particularly along the lake shores. When you have the opportunity to come into compliance and have a large enough lot to have a proper working septic system or stormwater management, that's also one other concern that this could perhaps address. So this is something that is used not only around shoreland but throughout the county. And so just wanted to be on the record stating that this is something that we do.
Representative Vanderveer?
And Mr. Chair, just to reiterate, however, we are not changing any of the septic requirements, building codes, setbacks, designating at all what's conforming and not conforming. None of that is being changed here.
Further questions? Okay. Anybody else want to speak for or against this bill? Okay. Do you want to continue forward with Representative Bender? Or do you want to work on it a little bit?
Well,
I hope we can address this. I think it's a very serious infraction. I'd like to see the bill go forward, but I want it to go forward with...
Mr. Chair, I do have one question. I've contacted the Environment Committee. I haven't heard back yet as to whether they would like to see it. I'm a little reluctant, though, because of time schedule to hold it here until I hear from them. So maybe the Chair could advise me on whether we thought we could move it maybe to... I was going to do it on the floor, but maybe we could move it out of here to Environment. Because it sounds to me after all this debate that you know, if we don't do it now, it could happen on the floor, that maybe it probably should go to Environment. I just...
Representative Vanderveer, if you're going to have to move it on the floor to Environment, it would take the same amount of time to do that as it would by holding it here and just moving it there. We could do it tonight.
Correct.
Or okay. Not tonight, tomorrow night, excuse me.
Okay. Well, then...
Well, no, that would take longer, wouldn't it? No. Yeah, it would. Sorry. That would take longer.
Thursday. Questions, can we move it out of here? Maybe, are you going to be meeting tonight?
No, we're meeting tomorrow night. Representative Vanderveer, I think it would be good for it to go to Environment.
Okay.
And we can address, I mean, what I just suggested, I think, is a good piece of solving some of the issues.
Okay.
The issue, and I just appeal to members, the issue that's before us is really what Representative Vanderveer's bill is about. The environmental issues are not our issues. And I find comfort with those issues being moved to Environment. And I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2965 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Environment Committee. With a commitment, I'm asking Representative Vanderveer a commitment that we'll have these issues worked on and addressed to the best extent possible in the Environment Committee.
Absolutely. I think the Environment Committee will certainly have, they can do what they want with the bills.
Because right now, today, members, our current policies are not addressing the environmental issue as they should. We have a disincentive to address them. And the policy on the zoning end of it, which is why it's here, is very problematic and causing problems in that respect. Any other discussion? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I do think that this bill should go to the Environment Committee if it makes it out of here, I really think that the bigger issue is whether or not the local unit of government should have the ability to do this. They have been granted, and that is within the jurisdiction of this committee. I think the committee ought to vote on that broader policy because I think this is a much broader policy and it has larger implications than a few lots. Again, with your other bill that we then reconsidered after it was more narrowly crafted, I think this has large-scale implications for non-conforming uses in not just these lakeshore lots, which have environmental issues, but lots in city areas and along roadways as well. So I'm not going to support the bill, but I do think it should go to the Environment Committee if it does make it out of here.
Representative Hillstrom, I'm glad you said what you did because I still cannot think of a case where any unit of government should have the right to limit a property owner just because they own two lots next to one another, when anybody else who owns those lots has that right.
Mr. Chair, maybe there needs to be better disclosure at the time of sale, and maybe we need to talk about property owners who have previously purchased property under non-disclosed or a non-aware status. But I think the fact that cities and counties do want to bring property into conformity, and we want them to do that over time, maybe we need to be talking about the disclosure at the time of the sale of a property or something along those lines to address this issue, rather than removing the ability for cities and counties to take care of this issue.
Representative Hillstrom, it's a very good discussion. I appreciate the colloquy. Because even with notice, we have still violated their rights and not provided just compensation. The amendment that I'm proposing, establishing tax policy that would require local units of government to adjust the valuation of that property to match the surrounding non-conforming lots, would provide that just could arguably provide that just compensation. Because remember, it doesn't fully provide that just compensation in respect that they can't sell the lot and they lose the valuation of it. I'm just talking about at least adjusting the valuation as it pertains to property taxes. And that's something I aim to bring up and work with up as it goes to the next committee. Because there should be a just compensation for this taking. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just compensation, or there needs to be some kind of a resolution passed by the governing body as to the reason it is non-conforming. If it meets the setbacks and it meets the first test and everything else, and the only issue is the ownership that has been identified, then there needs to be a clause for an intention to pull it out. If it needs to be non-conforming, but there's all kinds of reasons for non-conforming, but it doesn't necessarily address the fact that there is a residence that does meet the typical setback. And that somehow they have to establish what happens.
Mr. Chair.
Any other discussion? Representative Hillstrom.
Just a point to Representative Peterson. This is not just homes. I mean, this is commercial land and commercial development as well. So just a clarification.
Any further discussion? Motion has been renewed that House Bill 2965 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Environment Committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill will be passed as amended and sent to the Environment Committee. Thank you, Representative Vandiver.
Thank you, ma'am.
What? Dean, are you up? I really don't.
Dean.
Dave?
Representative Simpson.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move House File 3274 for passage and referral to the
General Register, I think.
She goes to the General Register.
Representative Garofalo moves that House File 3274 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. And members, I just want to bring your attention to the screen, and I certainly don't want to affect your presentation here at all, but I just can't resist this. If you look at the screen, we have an annexation bill coming up.
That's a string and balloon.
Representative Hornstein, I just wanted to note there is an amendment coming to that on string and balloon, and that's it right there. It's balloon connection.
Me and the chair have the same. Me and the chair think alike.
Thank you. Representative Simpson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To get the bill in order, I have an amendment I'd like to place on right away. It's the AO6 amendment, and we'd like to move that if we could, please.
-1277?
Yes, correct. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Garofalo moves the 1277 amendment, AO6-1277, to get it in the bill in the order the author would like. Discussion? All those in favor of the Garofalo motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Thank you. Representative Simpson.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to say that I've brought this bill forward on the request of the business community, in which I am part of. And also, I'd like to just say that I'm also a former mayor, so I know there's a line between regulation and a line between business. And I think that we have to be real careful where we go with both those lines.
This bill that we have brought forward is talking about commercial advertising regulations in windows and inside the establishment of a facility and on commercial machines that are used to store, display, or dispense products. We're not talking about parking lot signs. We're not talking about billboards. We're not talking about huge advertising signs on buildings. So I'd just like to clarify that before we get into the bill. With that being said, I think at this time I'd just like to turn over to Buzz Anderson, and he's going to talk about the bill.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Buzz Anderson. I'm president of the Minnesota Retailers Association. I want to thank the chair for the opportunity to speak today. I also want to thank Representative Simpson for offering the bill. And I also want to give a special thanks to Representative Hillstrom for the suggested amendment here as it relates to prohibiting, not prohibiting cities from prohibiting adult or sexually explicit materials. I think it was a good addition, and the intent there is to make sure we don't get into that discussion. We have no reason to want to support anybody who wants to display sexually adult material. Well, let me begin by saying that retail is a really tough business, and it's not the kind of business that if you're able to succeed, you can succeed because you won a lottery ticket. It isn't like that. It takes a great deal of courage, takes hard work, and there's some very steep financial risk in order to make a business go. So business does have to have a lot of pizzazz in order to try to attract that customer into the door to get them there in order to spend a dollar so they can make that investment pay off. It's a very costly venture. It's very, very competitive. Customer expectations are very, very high, and that also leads to very high customer demands. A common joke in retail is that if you really start to succeed in retail, you can cut down to half days, which is 12 hours. And I'm sure Representative Simpson can plug into that, but even when you're successful, you have to spend many, many numerous hours at your business to keep it going, to stay competitive. Of course, retailers are located in cities all over the state. I represent stores all over the state. And this is really an issue in more than just one city. It's an issue that continues to pop up in many, many communities. Retailers pay a large hunk of property taxes. They collect millions in sales tax dollars without compensation from the state like they do get in other parts of the country. They provide full-time and part-time jobs, and it's not uncommon for a retailer to offer many people their first-time job as they're stepping into that marketplace and learning customer skills and how to operate a cash register and use debit cards and credit cards and all those sort of things. Retailers also provide a wide array of products in every community at very, very competitive prices. If the prices are not competitive, they're not going to be in business very long, that's for sure. Now, there's some of a church group or a civic group or a school group that doesn't come to a retailer every day and ask for some sort of contribution. They also contribute to the community in that way, too. With that background, I just want to tell you a little bit about the bill that's before you today. It's offered by the Minnesota Retailers Association and the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association on behalf of members all over the state. All we're asking in this bill is very simply that a municipality not be allowed to prohibit the placement of signs in a store window or restrict sign placement within one's own retail establishment. The bill also does not allow restrictions on machines outside of a business. For example, you have an ice machine. You can say ice machine on it. If it's an ATM machine, it can say ATM. And if it's a pump, a gasoline pump, it can have a pump topper on top, which is prohibited in some communities. Again, thanks to Representative Hillstrom, we've squared away the question about sexually explicit material, and nobody wants to make that available in the community.
Yeah.
Let me just show you some examples of what I'm talking about, and Mr. Chair, with your indulgence in the committee, I'll ask my colleague, Lori Klimovich, to go through these slides. What you see in front of you is a very nice store in the city of Eagan. It's a store that was closed for quite a number of years and sat there abandoned, and a very enterprising person came along and I think set up a really nice you know, sign display within the windows. Laurie, I'm not sure what slide you're on, but if you go to the next one. One of the things I thought was really interesting was when I talked to this store owner, and I asked all store owners if I could take a picture of their stores. They said, yeah, go ahead. She said 85% of her business comes from walk-ins, from people that see the signs. There's four churches in the area, and those churches hold funerals quite often, and people say, oh, I forgot that funeral cart. I'll just stop there at the Balloon Connection. I see they have carts. It draws in a lot of her business. Laurie, if you do the next one, I guess you've got it. You can also see that under an ordinance, and particularly this is in the city of Eagan, you'd see that this is illegal because it violates the sign restriction that a sign cannot be it has to be below 4 feet and above 6 feet, and it also, your signage cannot comprise more than 25% of all your window signage. Or if you go to the next one. Now here's a pizza place in Eagan that's in the same strip mall. These people have been in business for 14 years. The business has been there for 25. Those locals have been on the window for 25 years. By the way, the governor and his family had pizza here on Friday night, so the owners told me, and they weren't offended by the signage. But this would be illegal under the most recent sign ordinance because it's between the 4 and 6 feet and because it covers more than 25% of all the window space. But this is something they rely on to draw customers into the store. Or if you do the next one. Now, I might also point out that what you saw on the last slide was that in the way I read the ordinance, if I read it correctly, that the sign that you see on top, the Focola's Pizzeria sign, is figured in with combination of your window signage to determine whether or not you've are covering more than 25% of the space of your windows as allowed by the ordinance. Well, interestingly enough, if you look at the application that you have to do to decide whether or not you're going past more than 25% of your window signage, you have to go through the application process. And I'd like the page, if you'd be so kind, or she'd be so kind, to pass out an application that an owner has to figure out whether or not they're complying with the city ordinance. Now, remember when your teacher told you in school, when you asked, well, when am I ever going to have to use math? Well, here's where you're going to have to use math. And I would just contend to you that it's very, very confusing for those people that are trying to make a buck, trying to comply with all kinds of other restrictions in law. Again, trying to get their suppliers, trying to get new employees with the large turnover, trying to deal with customer theft, trying to deal with all the issues that retailers have to deal with. Mm-hmm. Or if you go to the next one for me. Now, I've asked a couple of witnesses not to testify today because I'm going to be essentially talking about their business. One of them is a gentleman that owns a business like this. It's a liquor store, and of course, it's not uncommon for you to go to a liquor store and see their weekly specials. In fact, I think when you go up there, it's quite common for you to expect that that's what you're going to see. Well, these are all illegal according to the sign ordinance in this community because they're between the 4 and 6 feet regulation and because they comprise more than 25% of all the window space. Now, in this case, another store within a different spot in the community, if you look at the signs to the right, the one that says you can rent a second movie, you get a third one free, or the one that says you can rent movies for 7 days. If you look on the left or right of either of those, and I don't have a wide-angle lens, you see that they also have movie specials for the week or for the month. And they're actually provided by the supplier. They're well-done signs which show people what it is that they can shop for, and it draws a lot of people into the store. Or you can do the next one. Now, if you look at this one, this is the Border Books. The sign ordinance in this community has been interpreted to mean that if you have books or any other product in the window that's between the 4 and 6 feet that has a name of a product on it, that's considered a sign. So this window display of books is in violation of the sign ordinance. If you go to the next one, Hallmark. Point I want to make here is that a company like Hallmark, even though this is a franchise operation, they have to comply with certain regulations as part of a company that's part of a franchise operation. For example, the signs that are circled are signs or that have lines around them are signs that are provided by Hallmark, and you'll see this in every Hallmark sign around the country, except you won't see it in this community anymore because this is illegal according to the sign ordinance because it falls between the 4 and 6 range. Or if you do the next one, PetSmart is another franchise operation. And if you look here, you'll see that the sign down on the lower left is in violation because it's between the 4 and 6 feet and the signs on top are in violation because the signs in total comprise more than 25% of all the window space. Now, if you go to most gas stations around the state, you'll see pump toppers. What do people do when they're filling up with gas? They're looking at something, and they might as well look at a pump topper because it's a way to convey information. Maybe there's a special on coffee. Maybe there's a special on donuts. Maybe there's some other reason to bring them into the store. Gas prices are very competitive. If you can get them to come in and spend another nickel when they're in the store, rather than just using the remote, it can help add your profitability as a store. Now, I think this one's really interesting. I love this store, both as a consumer and one who runs the association, because we buy all of our cartridges for our printers and our toner cartridges from this store because they are 50% less than you'd get them from, you know, a chain store. And what's really interesting about this is that they've had to make very significant accommodations. Unless you go to a community like Representative Lincheski, and I'll show you what the cartridge world looks like in that community. You can see in that community that the logo that's on the right is actually the national logo for the company. And to accommodate the cartridge world in the previous slide, they had to actually probably violate their agreement, their franchise agreement, and make the cartridge world logo vertical, horizontal rather than vertical. So again, are they at jeopardy? Maybe. Is the regulation unreasonable? Absolutely. If you look at the other signs, the one that talks about 50% off, that's the thing that brings people in the store. They know that they can get a 50% discount on any cartridge that they have to put in the printer that they're selling. That's something that you want to convey to the customer. Again, I've asked that owner not to speak to anybody here if you have any questions. Or if you go to the next. Oh, that's it. Sorry. I guess I want to close by saying that, you know, there's somebody in the room who's going to testify against this bill today, I think. He's the mayor of my community, and I have a great deal of respect for him. He's a great mayor. He was a great public servant and had a distinguished career in law enforcement. He's even been so kind when 100 business people showed up the other night at a special city council meeting to ask the council to put a 60-day hold on this ordinance until a task force, which I'm going to sit on, has an opportunity to discuss this. But this is happening in communities all across Minnesota, and it really is getting in the way of the potential profitability of businesses who play a really important role in the community. One sign that you don't want to see in the community is one that says going out of business. And that's a sign that nobody cares to see. I'm going to ask Dave Blatnick from Super America to come forth and talk about a challenge that they have with these kinds of ordinances.
Begging your pardon, I don't want to disrupt your presentation at all,
sure.
But we aren't going to make our time today.
Okay.
And we have a 300 North at 4:30, and I need to ask if there's anybody besides all of you who couldn't make that meeting. We give them a chance to speak now, if it doesn't harm your presentation.
Oh, sorry.
Besides the members.
You got ways and means at 4:30.
So, okay. Okay, is it, Representative Simpson, is it all right with you if we adjust things a bit? Okay. Why don't you come forward and hope you can be as brief as possible. We have to be out of here already. and I don't want to deter you in any way your presentation, sir, so we just have to do the best we can. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please.
I'm Mayor Pat Gagan, and I want to thank both the chairperson of the committee and my representative, Wardlow, for allowing us to speak today. And I'll really try and condense this. You had a good tour of Egan, and no question about that. And a great deal of what Mr. Anderson explained, I am in agreement with. For those of you that have been public officials, I think that on a local level, signage is probably one of the worst things you hate to see in your docket. I don't know, I hate to say you can never get it right, but there's always a wide variety of issues associated with those. But I think it's important that we recognized that it didn't suit our business community. We had contacted the business community, we had sent out 3,000 letters, the chamber was involved, and it wasn't picked up on.
as far as the implication to our businesses. When it was, that was here just recently, they brought it back to us, and we said, we'll put it on a special meeting. We preempted some other business that we had, and we did, in fact, hear it. What we hope to do is, with the terms of a task force, of which our business community is part of, and some of these folks that you may or may not hear today are participating in that, to try and get it workable for everybody. The one thing that I would like to add, and it is a consideration, is I spent 30 years in law enforcement. 15 of it I was pushing a squad car. And there is some public safety implications. I think the store with the balloon connection that we were watching is a good example. That used to be a gas station. If you're in a squad car at 2 o'clock in the morning, drive around the corner, and that place is normally open, and you don't have anybody in it, the only way you're going to tell that is looking through the windows. And where's the convenience people? I don't know. It would prompt an officer to follow up on it. The other piece is a number of years ago, we were working a case with the Crime Bureau, doing a surveillance on a country club market. We had a burglary, and the next thing you know, we have shots fired, and it's a mess, but we couldn't see inside the windows to make our arrest, because it was, you know, rather typical of most markets. You have all your signage in the front. I think our issue is one that our city council wants to go back and address. And quite frankly, I don't have any real strong feelings as far as internally. But I think we need to address it as a city, and I think we need to. I think it's a local issue, quite frankly. And I open up for questions as to how we got here or anything that I could help with. And I have John Hornstein, our community development director, here as well.
Would you like to testify to, as well?
I have no prepared comments, but I'm happy to answer questions, sir.
Thank you, sir. Questions? Representative Markberg.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mayor. And I have a question. I mean, certainly there has to be more reasons for this ordinance than law enforcement to be able to look through windows. Maybe you want to expand on that. Because
certainly. And I think it goes back to a number of the stories you saw in this particular strip center. They're all together. And it's, you know, does it get cluttered? I guess it's an aesthetic issue for some. And how many signs are should you have and how many you shouldn't have. And that's exactly what everybody wrestles with. The other piece, too, is with today's technology, you've got lights flashing and all the rest of it, and that's why it's such a tough issue, quite frankly. And I think it's incumbent on the local level to involve our business community and work it out with those folks. And I think we can best do it. I had 75 people at a meeting the other night, all business people. It looked like a Rotary Club meeting. And, you know, we started to affect some change. And I think that's where it should be at.
Very quickly, please.
Yeah.
Representative Mayor, on this ordinance, was this a model from some other city or place in the U.S., or was this developed entirely by the city?
No, there were pieces of it from a number of other jurisdictions. Yes, sir. In Minnesota.
Representative Paymar and then Representative Peterson.
I can wait till later.
Okay.
So that's really a question to the author.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Merrill. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mayor, I appreciate your being here.
Thank you, sir.
I'm just trying to think what this ordinance would do to IKEA. Right? I mean, I just can't even imagine our community has, I don't know how many million square feet of retail. And I don't think that your ordinance is too dissimilar to our ordinance in Loon. And I would guess if we were to look at the AMM Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, you probably aren't too different than who else?
We have several.
I mean, Eden Prairie, right. Or Minnetonka, all the way around. So this thing, I picked up today, all right, Bloomington's ordinance is 20%. And again, it's a policing issue. The thing they pulled on me today was this whole thing of environmental design that deals with crime prevention. It is a major, major function. And that's why we don't let those windows get cluttered up.
And thirdly, most of our retail is associated with a multi-tenant owner. And if you have signage, Mr. Chairman, and the Balloon Store was part of a retail shopping center, the owner of that center would not allow that kind of signage. Simply will not see it in multi-tenant retail because the retailers themselves will not allow it. There is an environmental visual impairment, if you say, or some people just don't like it. So I'm glad you're here to testify, and I'm very concerned about this bill, and I hope that the League of Cities and the AMM and everybody else will log in on it, because we're getting into your jurisdiction, and if we were to pass this bill today, this committee better be prepared to go to every major city in the metropolitan area, wouldn't they? We'll start checking them off.
Right? Yeah. And we can share in the funds, Representative.
Off the pulpit, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just because there's going to be a break, I did actually bring up the statement about adult uses and making certain that if there was going to be a piece in the bill that I didn't want to spend the afternoon debating adult uses signage. But I'm not certain that the language that's in the bill, according to staff, is where it needs to be. So maybe you all can talk during the break.
Okay.
Thank you very much for allowing us to be here, sir.
Thank you, Mayor Geegan. Mr. Anderson, very quickly, we need to recess.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to address the committee and tell you that one of the other potential witnesses cannot come back tonight from Cartridge World, and he was going to offer an opportunity for you to ask any questions if you had any. So if there's anybody that has questions of Mr. Johnson, he's available right now but won't be this evening.
Okay. We have to be out here. The next committee has to be in here at 2:30. Begging your pardon.
Okay.
Mr. Representative Simpson, would you prefer, I don't know how we can schedule this. We're running out of time. Do you not want to have it tonight? Finish it up tonight?
Is that okay with the committee chair to hold it till the next, till this afternoon?
To hold it till this afternoon, yes.
At your request, we'll wait till the next time for finding out.
Okay. We're recessed until 4:30 p.m. and room 300 north.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How long do you anticipate that we should plan to go this evening just for
we'll
people's planning?
Finish the agenda. The Biskin bill shouldn't take five minutes. So we have this and the Biskin bill.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, and so we won't be doing anything with annexation this evening?
No.
Thank you.
Yeah, if not, except for annexation. We'll just talk about it briefly. Make sure you have all the amendments in hand so you can look at it. That's the reason I want to finish this agenda tonight, so we have tomorrow night for annexation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're recessed until 4:30 in room 300. Thank you.
This is Representative Mark Olson. I call the March 22nd meeting back in order. It's about 4:40. And recessed on the Simpson bill, and I've been asked, because it's only going to take us a couple minutes to do the Biskin's bill. This bill was up before us last year. We passed it out with recommendations to pass and go to civil law, and we just simply need to bring it up so everybody knows and remembers what we did, and we need to move it again to civil law. So the chair will move that House File 587 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. To that bill and motion, Representative Biskins, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, there are some changes that have to be made, but those are very simple. They're in the title and the effective date. It's titled the Voting Act of 2005. We need to change that in the effective date. But I believe, Mr. Chairman, those things, if this committee is comfortable, can be changed in the next committee.
Okay,
and I'll offer a formal amendment. So, Mr. Chairman, members, I'd appreciate your support.
Any questions for
Mr.
Rush?
Mr. Chair, do we have a copy of the bills? I was in the Rules Committee, and I don't have any paperwork on what we're doing with it.
It's the Quarterly Election Day Act.
Oh.
Remember that?
I like that. Though.
Yeah. Any other questions? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate Representative Biskins bringing this forward. You know,
I'd actually like to see us go down to about 3 days. You know, the township day in March and the primary day and then general election. We complain about voter turnout, but we have so many different times and so forth. It would be nice to standardize and say for everyone maybe 3 different dates. And also, and I know it's another day, but for school bond issues, we had one locally in my district, and this was a 30-some million dollar project, and it would have built a new school in a new area, but between the district there, and they held that election in mid-December. And it just, I think, and there's a lot of people that were complaining about that, and I think anytime you come to an election, there shouldn't be any, what's the word I'm looking for? Any doubt that everything is legitimate and it's thundering. So we kind of set normal times, and I think that would help our voter turnout and have greater predictability, but also even add some credibility to some of the elections that I know there's always complaints and a lot of on school elections on when they're held and so forth. And I know the schools would feel that, you know, it's really taken a lot away, but I think, especially when you have senior citizens who go south in our area, that when you hold an election can be very important.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Biskens, I do have a question because my district has just had its third school operating levy, 53 days before each of the three elections. Those elections needed to be approved by the department, and the commissioner had to sign off on them. And so what impact would this have on those approved elections by the commissioner?
Representative Biskens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, this bill would take the politics out of that, and the commissioner would no longer have the ability to approve special dates. The dates would be set so that the citizens would know on these 5 days throughout the year. These are days set aside to vote.
Further discussion? Representative Wardlaw.
Aye.
Representative Biskens.
Mr. Chairman, I'm feeling the love. As soon as you're ready.
All right. The chair renews his motion that House File 587 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The bills pass and be sent to the Civil Law Committee.
Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Representative Biskens. Next, Representative Simpson and the rest of your testifiers. Representative Garofalo renews his motion. The chair renews Representative Garofalo's motion that House File 3274 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the General Register. Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Having visited with the mayor and some of the people that were concerned about this issue and talking with Mr. Anderson and Mr. Krogman, I think at this point, at this time, I'm going to ask to hold this bill over. But I would certainly hope that the mayor and other mayors and the business community look very seriously at this because it is an issue that has arisen and is... I think they need to pay more attention to their business community and respectfully ask for their opinion before they pass these ordinances and bless their business with these. If we see that this issue continues to be a problem, we definitely will pursue other avenues. So at this time, I'd like to thank the committee for their time and the chairman also.
Well, thank you, Representative Simpson. I think you're making everybody happy. They can go home and eat. Any questions from members? So you don't have anybody who wants to testify anymore?
No, I just think we've been here. We both want to go home.
At least your objectives. Any further discussion? Okay. The bill will be held over.
Task force.
Thank you, Representative Simpson. Members, I guess, announcements. Announcements.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I probably should ask you this after, but the bill of mine that has been laid on the table...
Anytime you want, Representative Hillstrom. We got to get together. I got whoever wants to pitch in and try to work on something to help. I fully agree we should address the issue, just like today with Representative Vandegrift. But I felt the issues were the Environment Committee's issues. and with yours, I think there are issues. And I think we should work on something to give some direction to the local municipal government as to how they can resolve it. And
actually, we did talk to legal staff, and there's not really going to be a way to resolve the issue without a court battle. We could probably direct someone like the Attorney General to take it on, but that's going to have fiscal costs. And so at this point, probably our only option is going to be to decide if we want the county to do it or if we want it to go to the local level of government first so they can opt in to control it or not. And so other than that, barring a lawsuit, we're not going to fix it.
Okay. Well, that's good information to have as we consider the bill. Thank you. So, are you, Representative Hillstrom, are you thinking there's some sort of amendment that could help that direction and work at the local level?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I would offer an amendment, and you probably like this, that would simply say that the lowest unit of government, then the government would get the first option to regulate it. If the township or the city would probably get it first.
Yeah, I would like that.
I knew that you would. And then the county would get the option if, in the event that one of the lower levels didn't take it first.
Okay.
So, given that, if you would be so kind as to put it on the agenda, I would greatly appreciate it for another meeting.
Does it refresh me? Does it have to go anywhere else?
No, I think it goes straight to the floor.
I thought it did.
I think it goes straight to the floor.
Yeah, okay. All right, we'll probably do it Monday.
Perfect.
But I'll talk to Mary.
Okay.
Annexation. Tomorrow night. The reason why I wanted to finish, I thought the Simpson bill was going to take us a long time. And the reason I wanted to finish our today's agenda for before tomorrow night is I want to make sure we had all the time we need for annexation tomorrow night. So this document you have in your packet, 149, that represents what we had understood was accepted by the straw polls, if you will. As some of you have told me we were doing straw polls. That represents what we approved as a group, as a committee, for language that, you know, it's not 100% consensus, but it's, you know, mutual agreement. Both sides at the table seem to concur with it, and on that basis, it's a consensus. One comment on that, another way I'm trying to define this consensus is that I hope we stay away from a bill. When I call it a committee bill, it doesn't mean I'm referring to the process, yes, mostly, but I'm also trying to say let's not have a package where we take a township provision and then we trade it for a city provision and then we trade it for a township provision and a city provision, and all the provisions are contentious yet, but they've been traded off and we have some sort of agreement. When that gets out there and is implemented in the community, I don't think that solves problems. Because we've traded one another's issues, and there's still issues. So when I talk about consensus bill, I hope we think about how can we compromise each item. And as the amendments are introduced, there'll be quite a few. We'll allow the city and township to represent their views. And if we hear from that there's maybe something we could do to create a compromise, then maybe we'll do that. If we feel the compromise really is reached and we need one or the other sides to say, hey, you know, this really, the committee disagrees with both of you here.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Peterson.
We already have a law.
Mm-hmm.
So that has to be the benchmark from where we were.
It is.
I mean, there's no sense. And what we need to do is go through the existing and say, do you want to change it or not? And if you do, where do you want to go? What happened to us yesterday, I haven't had a chance to look at this, was all of a sudden there was a new bill that was a whole new paradigm, whole new areas. And I keep saying, no. We have an existing law that someone's trying to convince us that we should change one part or two parts or three parts of that. So we have to start with that as our grid.
Representative Peterson, that's what we're doing.
Okay. So this is the existing...
That's correct.
...section, whatever it is.
This is the existing statute on annexation with the five provisions that we had support for from both sides.
Yesterday.
This is a new amended version.
Okay. I'll go along until I catch up.
3 hours if you were gone.
Right.
Okay, so you weren't there for that part.
No. I had to go make a living last night. I missed that piece.
Okay. We started the process we're going to complete tomorrow night.
Okay.
And that is, here's the document, and then we had the cities and townships represented at the table, and as we went through the various amendments that were presented to the committee the other day, we found five of them that both sides agreed to, and the committee, everybody on the committee said, let's put them in the bill. So this is the existing law plus those five provisions.
Okay.
Now we'll complete that process, which is really what you just described, of looking at the rest of the amendments, and some we put on what we call the work table, where we try to, Representative Markwart and I got together, and I suspect others as well, looked at those amendments to craft changes in them to see, again, if we get an agreement.
Okay.
So we're trying to find compromise and not trade off one issue for another issue.
That would just be a nightmare.
That's the only thing I'm trying to articulate here. Let's not take Amendment A and trade it for Amendment B. Take Amendment A, and we either agree with it or we don't.
Yeah.
I'm trying to define some sense of consensus.
Mr. Chair, if I might, the Chair and I actually got together after the committee hearing as well and talked about our vision of how we will then proceed with the so-called committee bill, and kind of talked about how then on the floor when the bill is presented, the committee will all have the opportunity to say, we worked on this as a committee, and while that issue came up, we did not come to a consensus on it, and while you may support it or I may support it, it's not in the bill because we couldn't have a meeting of the minds on the provision.
Let's say we pass the bill out and there were some amendments that failed and they come up on the floor. The way I'm committed to represent the bill is say, you know what, it doesn't matter that I support that amendment, I'll vote accordingly. But that came up in committee, and the committee did not approve that. And here's the reason I know they didn't approve it, and maybe Representative Hillstrom wants to speak to it as well, or you, Representative Peterson, or somebody else. So that we're trying to represent what the committee action and the committee bill really is.
Are we prepared to pull the bill if they start trying to bombard it with amendments?
If
our people or anybody starts coming, are we ready? Do we have enough personal fortitude in this process to say we'll pull it?
Representative Peterson, with all due respect, I don't necessarily call that fortitude because we're a minority of the body. And I don't like when that happens, even though it's part of our culture here. I call it cultural process. What I'm trying to say is that if this bill became a city bill and something I personally couldn't support, I've always stated from the beginning that I would agree to give it to a city, a representative who's a city representative. I'm both. I talk township because my dad's a township supervisor for 40 years, and if he ever gets a hold of these tapes and hears otherwise, I'm in trouble. Oh, seriously, I represent both. And
the reason I'm asking that question, Mr. Chairman, is that if this truly is a committee bill, then I think we have to demonstrate that if there's going to be any bill at all, it's going to be the committee's bill. Otherwise, we're going to go through the same hearings we're going through now. That thing will go on infinitum, and we won't know at the end of the deal whether the committee's hanging together or not. And after about two or three of those, I would guess that most of the committee members will break from the pack,
Sure. Go
on their way, and we'll be right back to where we are now.
These are good points of discussion. I want to encourage us to consider not concluding how we'll respond to this until we get done with the bill. Yes. See what shape it's in, because there are a number of things we could do as a committee of just discussing and making some points and even making a proposal of how we'll present this on the floor. I anticipate that I'll be the author of it, unless there's objection. And that's fine if there is. I don't mind that. But when we get to the floor, certain areas where members are feel very strongly about, I'd like to see all the various members who feel strongly about anything in the bill be a part of presenting the bill on the floor, so that we're presenting it as a committee bill, so the members see how much we put into it. By doing that, I feel we'll communicate something to the body. And that's just an idea I'm going to throw out there. Again, when we get done with this process and we see what we really have, if it's something we really, really have a lot of support for, if we're able to compromise things and bring both sides together, if we had a unanimously supported package, I would submit that maybe we could approach it very strongly with fortitude like you're talking about. I just don't know that we'll get there, so I'm apprehensive to say, let's do that. But if we do, and if we have that good a package, and both sides agree at the table here, I could see us going to the floor and saying, you know what? There's so much work into this, we don't want to lose it. And let's go to the floor and say, we don't want amendments. You can introduce them, but we're all voting against them. And we're going to advocate for such. I just don't want to see it done in a threatening way. Say, the bill dies, I'm pulling it. Members have that right. And they're on this committee. And I want to respect that right.
Okay. Give it a whirl.
Representative Woodlow.
I was just going to respond. This is a committee bill, but the purpose of this committee is to put what we think is the best bill forward, and then it's up to the body to decide what that bill's like. And I just want to reiterate, I don't know if we say we're going to pull the bill very quickly, then we're saying our expertise is far superior to the body's expertise in the House floor, and that's what we're saying. And we know it's not, especially in my case.
Representative Hillstrom, then Representative Lane.
Representative Wardlow, I agree with that. However, even as we saw with Representative Broad, she made her proposal to us saying this is compromise language. Everyone has agreed in the House and the Senate. We've all agreed in that. And we're committed to the compromise. And so we do hear that people do that all the time. And so there are ways to approach that if that's the way this committee really feels.
But there's a difference when a member says, I'm pulling the bill, and you can't even act on this if you don't go along with my deal. That's where the line, I think, gets crossed. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To this point, I want to go on record of saying what I've told both township and city folks. We can't control what other members of the body may want to do. If we do have a bill that we arrive at a consensus on, recognizing we can't control individual members, but we can control what we as a committee do. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to spend all this time and effort trying to find the places of compromise, then I would hope that this committee would stand behind our product and say, we've considered all these other things, and this is the best bill. We would oppose these amendments. And I guess to both the city and township people, I would say to them that I would hope that there would not be amendments that they would be encouraging members to put forward. Because if we go through this process and come up with a document that has reasonable acceptance on both sides of the issue, then I hope that we would respect that and honor that and not play games with this. But if we pass out a bill here and go to the House floor only to go through and resurrect all the amendments and all the things we've been talking about here, then this will be a wasted exercise. And all we're going to do is further polarize this issue. And so I just wanted to say that for the record.
Appreciate that, Representative Lanning. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Lanning made just about all the points I wanted to make. I strongly agree with them. But I also, Mr. Chair, appreciate how steadfast you've been in terms of, wanting to come up with a committee bill and some consensus on a very polarized issue. But I do feel that in some ways it is a high-risk strategy because we all are aware of the legislative process. We're aware of groups they both make good points on certain issues, the townships and the cities. But this is really very polarized, and it just feels like we could come up with something, and then who knows what happens afterward, despite good intentions. And so I have concerns about that it is pretty high risk. I have concerns that it could be a lot of work for naught. And my final point is that I do feel we have a vehicle to move this issue forward rather than end in failure, which is Representative Hosh's bill.
He has a green jacket on it now. It's the bill that calls for, you know, a task force that really forces a process that will come up with, you know, a bill and some consensus and some communication that we haven't had before. And I would really just view that as an important alternative that ought to be considered, because that would be a truly committee bill, and I think it would hopefully be a bill that everybody here could agree to. But I think yesterday showed me that we're still so far apart with this issue. And, you know, if we can get some language that everyone agrees to, great. You know, I support that. But I just feel like it's real subject to, you know, a lot of variables that are out of our control, much as we would like them to be, Mr. Chair. So I want to just get people really thinking and focused about Representative Hosh's bill and as an alternative, because I think that's a little lower risk, but it moves us forward.
To this point, Representative Wardle, is there any reason we couldn't consider that bill along with this one? Why not? Just because this bill passes, whatever we come up with, passes the House floor, doesn't mean we can't study it some more and see if it can be improved by the task force. Am I wrong in thinking that?
Representative Wardle, it could be considered along with, it could be a piece of this. Just as the analogy was used with regard to how we deal with workers' comp, workers' compensation issues, and have an ongoing overview on those issues to see how things are going. Representative Hornstein, the only thing I actually disagree with in one respect is that any other process is going to better assure we'll have a committee bill. This is the kind of issue where I don't think there's any process that will ascertain that. I really don't. If people are hired to come here and work to represent either side and they're paid large sums of money to take a position because they like things the way they are, we are not going to convince them to change. And if in the world of campaigns and politics, funds are used to support members of this committee or members of the body sufficient to influence them with regard to a particular position, it's not going to change. It just isn't going to change. That's why I appeal to members to not simply just... It's the reason I don't take PAC money. It gives me a lot of freedom. We're all human beings, and it's not a negative thing. It's not a wrong thing to be influenced by that. I just know that principles should be above politics.
Well, Mr. Chair, you have no argument for me. I think that we need a lot of campaign finance reform and lobbying reform, and you know, I appreciate your position on that.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last thought. One way to make certain that there aren't lots of amendments that are germane to this bill is that when we actually draft the bill, we're going to be working out to include sections that we need to include, and thereby making 10,000 other things matching the bill. But we put forward the entire chapter. Every single item in this chapter has a germane availability.
Representative Hillstrom, the bill is in its form, the document, not bill. This document is in its current form simply for working with in this committee, and the only motion we need to remind ourselves to make before we pass it out is to delete the sections that are not necessary in this document to move the bill forward, to move it forward and have it become a bill. So a simple motion, verbal, we don't need an amendment to that effect. We just need to remember to do it. Okay. Any other discussion? I was right. We didn't make it till 5:00.
If there's no further discussion, meeting's adjourned.